frown.
Good evening and welcome to Schraber Live, a celebration of Daniel Paul Schraber's book, Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. This event was made possible by Das Unbehagen, a psychoanalytic organization, the International Society for the Psychological and Social Approaches to Psychosis, and the Hearing Voices Network New York City, which is a group of activists seeking to change the way we think about voices, visions, and other extreme or unusual experiences. Schraber's book, which is at once a memoir, a historical document, and a judicial treaty in support of his release from the asylum, is one of the most widely known and cited first-person accounts of what is commonly termed madness. Like the book, the Jefferson Market Library is not only a location for literary pursuits, but once served as a courthouse during the 1800s. In the garden behind the building stood a woman's house of detention, demolished in 1973. The brick-arched basement served as a holding cell for prisoners on their way to jail or trial. In more recent times, the library was also the site of the first community-based non-clinical group for voice hearers in New York City. Today, as we celebrate Daniel Paul Schraber's book, within this courthouse-turned library, there is a sense of redemption, of his words being taken seriously, given their rightful place not only within a literary institution, but also within a lawful one.
Welcome to Schraber Live. This room is, we're calling it today the Four Courts of Heaven, so welcome to the Four Courts of Heaven. Just to give you a basic schema, I put up some signs to direct people. We are in the Four Courts of Heaven. There will be largely scholarly, short scholarly talks here. Downstairs will be the Lower God, where we're going to have a video project by Luce DeLeer, Patrick Scanlon doing a 16mm film installation art, and the Upper God will have largely performance and performance art, and of course we're going to have reading happening throughout directly from favorite text. I'm going to start with one quote from the Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. God did not really understand the living human being, and he had no need to understand him, because according to the order of the world, he dealt only with corpses. As we prepared for the event today, we were alert for various Schraberian enactments, and we were not disappointed. 2 days ago marked what I now think of as the day of the frayed nerves, a day that culminated with my completely rewriting the schedule at 11 p.m. only to have Marie ask me why I needed to change anything. I was stunned to realize that I had no rational reason whatsoever. I understood nothing. As we prepare for tonight's program, I come back to the question of understanding that Schraber poses. Given the impossible multiplicity of performances happening concurrently tonight, in an event that is designed to be structurally impossible for any one person to take in its entirety, are we in fact posing a willful assault on understanding? Would it be all too convenient to suggest that the experience of going from the talks here in the Four Courts of Heaven to the video installation in the Lower God, and then to the performances of the Upper God, all the while being accosted by the constant reading of the Schraber book, that all of this might be relevant to a different kind of understanding, a lived understanding of the Schraberian world, a world in which God himself did not really understand the living human being. This is such a stunning claim that we scarcely notice that it is not only that God does not understand, but beyond this, God does not need to. You're forced to consider a slacker God who only does what he needs to do. This being the case, we suggest that it is okay to not understand. Not even God understands. It is not clear if he could understand if he needed to. Please find your way from space to space and also allow yourself to pause and listen closely to the readers of the book from the tested souls who will be reading and scattered throughout the castle today. We have tried to build in movement into our program because there are few books that are as embodied as Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. Although the memoir is a book that concerns the judgment of the law and the judgment of psychiatry, we invite you to abandon the role of judge, asking is it good, is it crazy, bad, or boring, and we offer you several opportunities for active participation in performance art, to move around and talk to the artists and look at the artwork the dancing, and listening to the music throughout. We invite you to take Schraber into your own body, just as God has apparently taken residence within Schraber's body. Thank you for coming to Schraber Live.
First thing I'd like to do is acknowledge that these proceedings will be taking place on the unceded territory of the Lenape Nation. My name is Wayne Wapimakwa, and I'll be keeping us to our schedule tonight, so please forgive me of my paternal frustration threats, which will be forthcoming. Our first speaker tonight is Henry Lefebvre. In his 1996 book, My Own Private Journey, you may go upstairs if you so choose. There are concurrent things happening there.
For performance upstairs, lecture here, Dr. Lothe will be starting with the first lecture.
Our first speaker tonight will be Henry Lothe. In his 1996 book, My Own Private Germany, Daniel Paul Schraber's Secret History of Modernity, Eric Sattner called him the, quote, de facto dean of contemporary Schraber studies. He has 35 publications on Schraber, 2 books, and 1 co-edited paper. Dr. Lefebvre.
Thank you very much. I noticed you have a button, and I also have a button which I forgot to bring with me. It said, I'm crazy about Schraber. And I have been so since 1989, even earlier. You heard Evan talk about Schraber's God. You're already in a delusional state, Evan, because when Schraber said that God deals only with corpses, he didn't mean God. He meant his psychiatrist, Flexig and Weber, because Flexig kept brains in jars in his great office of dead people, and he also dealt with corpses, and so did Weber, who wrote the dissertation about autopsies of corpses. So when Schraber talks about God, you have to be careful which God he's talking about. Because his wife said that Flexig was mad and he thought he was God. So this was also a hidden parody and irony of Schraber about psychiatrists who understood nothing except corpses. They certainly didn't understand him. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. The second one is that the book that Evan mentioned, Mary, The Great Thoughts of a Nervous Patient, has been mistranslated as Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. No. He was a nervous patient, but he also had great thoughts. And this was his intention. Now, what Ida McAlpin and her son, Richard Hunter, omitted is translating the subtitle of the book. And the subtitle of the book is very important because the book itself, the whole book is a juridical document. And it said, under what circumstances can a person considered insane be held against his will in an asylum? So this addressed immediately the issue of the power of psychiatry and the arrogance of psychiatry to decide who's crazy and who is not, and also incarcerate them. So Schraber was incarcerated in the asylum called Sonnenstein against his will beyond the time when he wanted to stay there. He wanted to leave in 1897. However, he was also declared mentally and legally insane due to the machinations of his wife. And few people know about that. They had a fight about money, and his wife would sign the remittances and come to the ministry to collect his paycheck. So they said, this is not in order. And so the woman said, what should I do? He said, well, go to the judge and apply to declare him mentally incompetent, in which case you get control of the assets, which she did. So when Schraber wanted to leave, the asylum director said, number one, you have a chronic illness, paranoia caused by your brain. Number two, you're legally insane, therefore you cannot leave. He would have kept him there for life. Schreiber fought his way out of the clutches by mounting his own self-defense in the court. And the judges said, well, he still has some crazy ideas, but this is not a reason to hold him here. And they gave him back his freedom. So that's the story of the iniquities and cruelties of psychiatry in Germany around the turn of the century. Now, I also propose, and I prove it in my writing, that Schreiber was not crazy. He was exactly what he said. He was a nervous patient. He suffered from insomnia, from depression, and from anxiety. Now, when he wrote the book as an act of reminiscence and an act of proving that he was not psychotic, he said, I have had all kinds of fantasies. The psychiatrist said these fantasies were delusions. With this, I say, is the delusion of the psychiatrist. It's they who are crazier than the patient. Schreiber had insight into his fantasies and talked about some of them as delusions. He himself said it. I know there's something that I thought was a delusion, but not everything. So his God Discourse is a fantastic text. And I refer to you to a work by Svetan Todorov on the fantastic, which makes me say that Schreiber's book is not about any mental illness. It is not about any psychosis. It's a literary work and a work of self-vindication. Have I convinced anybody? Now, given that, anyone can have all kinds of fantasies about his fantasies. And here's my point. Life is made up of dramas. Things happen to people all the time. The drama was a genre invented by the Greeks 2,500 years ago. But it's something which refers to what happens in life and what can also be made into literature. So after the drama comes the story. We see it in our president. He's very dramatic, and then he makes up stories. So all the interpreters of Schreiber also made up all kinds of stories. And that is fine. That means that Schreiber is interesting, fascinating, and is still being kept alive by the fact that we talk about him. But be aware that the narrative is something which can change all the time. Drama, as a historic fact, is a fact that remains the same forever. So Schreiber's drama was his interaction with psychiatry. And you can say there were all kinds of dramatis personae. There was Schreiber, there was Flexi, the first psychiatrist, there was Weber, the second psychiatrist, there were attendants, there were nurses, male and female. There was his wife, there was his mother, never mentioned by Freud. So all kinds of dramatic interactions took place, and everyone has a narrative about it. So I come now to Freud. Freud's work about Schreiber is an explanation of Schreiber is completely worthless. There was no homosexuality, there was no paranoia, there was nothing to talk about. There are two great things that he said in that essay, however, and this is why I said, Freud caught a carp of truth with a bait of falsehood. The carp of truth is when he said that what is considered pathology by everybody is actually a work of reconstruction and recovery by the patient. So his fantasies were his way of healing himself, including the fantasy of turning into a woman. He did not become a woman because he says at the end, I know I'll die as a man. But I needed these fantasies to keep myself calm and not nervous. And this is what we all do. Each has its own stories of calming or relaxing fantasies. That's what fantasies are for. So the other thing that Freud said is, the future will show whether there is more delusion in my theory or more truth in the delusion of Schreiber. So this is why I say, Evan, we can have all kinds of delusions about Schreiber, which is fine too. But let's be clear as to who does what and to whom. How much more time do we have?
8 minutes.
8 minutes? How many?
Eight.
More, 8 more minutes?
8 more, yes.
Oh, great. Now, what I also propose to say is the reason why Schrader was persecuted is not because he did anything crazy and he argued to the court, I'm not gemeingefährlich, I'm not dangerous to anyone. What he was judged upon is the way he spoke. It was only a matter of language. And what I want to propose is the following. There are 4 P's that use language which is against common sense and ordinary experience, i.e. fantastic language. The prophet, the poet, the so-called psychotic, and the child. How come nobody asked me what is the 4th P?
Where's the 4th P?
The 4th P is in the word pediatrics. It comes from the Greek word paidos or pais, which means a child. So all these persons speak a language which is based on the body, on embodiment, and imagination. And they use their own, they use the same language as we do, the same words, but they mean something different. What they mean is their emotions as they experience them in their bodies and in their souls. So it's based on that that Schrader was incarcerated as an incurable psychotic, because he was able to talk in parables and metaphors and similes, as he said himself, about things supernatural and spiritual, which do not lend themselves to common day discourse. But if he's crazy, then you can say the same thing about religion and theology and everything else. What is theology? So, what was Schrader's theology? He says at the end, the psychiatrist only understood, only observed his pathological self, but he didn't understand the spiritual depth of his soul. And I want you to give an example of that spiritual depth. Now, the important thing that I found is that Schrader's narrative is based on Faust, on Goethe's Faust, and on the Book of Job. In both of these cases, an innocent man is persecuted by God with serious bodily and physical and other illnesses. And Schrader says, God, this did to me too. But luckily, with his help, even though he was against me, I was able to overcome it. And I'm going to read to you how he expresses it. There is no, the order of the world, and he talks about the negative and the positive order of the world, this one is the positive one, is the lawful relation which, resting on God's nature and attributes, exists between God and the creation called to life by him. God cannot achieve what contradicts his own attributes, and his power is in relation to mankind, or, as in my case, to an individual human being who had entered into a special relation with him. God, whose power by race is essentially constructive in its nature, it's an old Gnostic idea and Kabbalistic idea, it's very, very good. God's power by race is essentially constructive in its nature and creative, came into conflict with himself, when he attempted the irregular policy against me, aimed solely at destroying my bodily integrity and my reason. So it was God's punishment for some sins unknown. This policy could therefore only cause temporary damage, but could not lead to permanent results. Or perhaps, using an oxymoron, God himself was on my side in his fight against me. That is to say, I was able to bring his attributes and powers into battle as an effective weapon in my self-defense. These are very important words, and they betray no sign of psychosis. And there are many such statements in this book, but also it's written in two styles. One is the simple prose, where he talks about the events of his life that led to becoming a patient, and then the fantastic text, theological, spiritual in nature, but fanciful and fantastic by itself, where he explains many other things. One of his main fantasies was he was becoming a woman, a pregnant woman. Now Freud said that this was his wish to be fucked in the ass by his psychiatrist, pardon my French. Passive homosexual wish, he said. Well, how did Freud know? He sucked it out as a finger, as they say in German. Out of a finger, out of his organ. Schreber's reason for saying this is because he had a wife who had four miscarriages and gave birth to two dead children, the last one 1 year before he got sick, in 1892. There are documents to that effect which are found in Leipzig. So, as a result, in my view, he was making a gesture of compassion towards his wife. You couldn't do it, I'll do it for you. So, this is as much as I need to say. Thank you for listening.
Figured out that what I'll do is I'll start waving speakers down. We have 2 minutes left just to keep us on track so you guys know what's going on. Our next speaker tonight is Gregory Shanklin. Greg is a business strategist with an emphasis on behavior and culture and a voice hearer with about 40,000 hours of aware analysis of the phenomenon and experience of hearing voices. He is also the creator of Mad Sense, which offers new insights for voice hearers, family members, friends, mental health professionals, and researchers to break through the mad experience. Please welcome Gregory.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I put 40,000 hours kind of in my sort of intro for that, just to give kind of people an idea of what this is like. You know, when we sort of talk about kind of stories and how we interpret all of this stuff, you know, philosophically, what I would like to do today is actually just remind you a little about what the experience is like in the moment when it's actually happening to you. Just to give you a kind of different perspective, because for me, what happens with hearing voices, you know, I looked at this very technically. I had a marvelous childhood growing up in sunny South Africa, small towns, canoes, fishing, bicycles, going fishing every weekend, an uncle with a farm. I mean, very much in touch with nature, very loving environment. Did well at school, went to university more than once. Studied engineering, first of all. You kind of see that in my sort of very technical approach to this. And then studied commerce later on and got involved in business consulting. Just went from, as I say, you know, small town South Africa to running a consultancy, you know, a global consultancy here in New York. So it's pretty, you know, so I asked myself, you know, how did somebody who was kind of pretty successful succumb to this fear that was associated with hearing voices, where fear was not an emotion I ever really experienced beforehand in any real sense. How did I become manic? How did I become paranoid rather, in this whole experience? So within a matter of weeks, when I first started hearing voices 9 years ago, I was living in Hell's Kitchen, one of these typical sort of Hell's Kitchen apartments with a fire escape outside, a flight of stairs across the window. I heard this female voice saying, "He seems to be okay." Of course, I knew I was in my apartment on my own, looked around, couldn't figure out where it was. There's a male voice grunting in the background, sort of, "Mm." The female voice then commented on what I was doing. I was making something to eat. So there obviously had to be line of sight. And my brain just worked it out from there. It has to be line of sight. Who could see into the apartment? Don't have to see what I was doing. It had to be somebody looking from the fire escape. Who had access? Must be the upstairs neighbors. Very logically, you know, and in no time at all, I reached that conclusion. Later on that evening, I sort of carried on that satisfied my emotions for the moment. Later on that evening, I thought, it's a slightly unusual way for people to be checking up on me. Sorry, what I missed was, in asking the question, why would somebody do that? I realized I had hurt myself earlier that afternoon in the bathroom and made a bit of a song and dance about it. I jumped around making more noise than I would ordinarily make. So I assumed that was why they were sort of checking up on me. Later that evening, I ran upstairs, knocked on their door, and kind of said, thank you, I am okay. There was nobody there, and I just went back to bed, and was quite happy with that. The next day, the voices continued. And again, the following day, and then they started talking about things that had happened prior to that day. So obviously, voices had been sort of spying on me or noticing me for a bit longer. And this went on, literally in a matter of days, I had sort of called friends to come and have a look, come and have a listen. They couldn't find anything. I'm now still convinced it's the neighbors that are being now really intrusive, and I start to look for evidence of how my neighbors are actually spying on me, because that's how it felt. I had no reason why they would be doing it, but that's the point. The most plausible conclusion was that it had to be the neighbors, and that was not an outcome that was actually pleasant, obviously. And that's what led to the stress. Not kind of long story short, escalated. Within 5 weeks, I had moved out of the apartment. It was a furnished apartment I was renting, so it was kind of quite easy for me to do. And in the last few days of being in the first apartment, voices had started following me outside. And when that happened, I realized that, okay, this couldn't be my neighbors anymore. But by now, I was so sort of stuck on electronic mechanisms for how my neighbors might have been spying on me. That was kind of an idea sort of carried around with me for a short while sort of afterwards. Until I went to a doctor in about week 5 or 6, and he described it as auditory hallucinations. And I'm very thankful for that description. Because what it did for me was it changed my perception of what this thing might be completely. It didn't define me in any way. To me, my interpretation of that was simply that it was something weird in my brain. My brain was probably misfiring, producing all these sort of unusual inputs, even though I could not relate that to the experience of these voices at all, which were downright malign, miserable, vicious things that were now sort of by this stage attacking me all day, every day. And the phenomenology had shifted from voices talking to each other about me to very quickly escalating within that sort of first 3 weeks to my thoughts being half of an interaction with voices. So voices were interacting with each of my thoughts. Because that puts your focus on your thoughts, because ordinarily, and it makes it equivalent to a real live experience. So ordinarily we would think about something before sharing it with someone else. So in this context, what's happening is every thought is being shared as half of a conversation, and your brain is picking it up as a real experience, and you're recording all of those signals and all of your reward signals, which in this case don't feel very rewarding, through this kind of process. And I say at the rate of literally now, I would say something of the order of 40,000 hours. I read an article somewhere not that long ago that says the average person has somewhere between about 50 and 70,000 thoughts a day. I reckon that voices provoke probably 4 or 5 times that, and that I have a very, very, very busy head. Good mildly. So in the end, I understood this in the context of neurolinguistic programming. I had studied neurolinguistic programming in the business world before starting to hear voices. What neurolinguistic programming does, it kind of teaches you that actually the language that we use is something you can use to program your mind differently. So, and in fact, very, very simply, neurolinguistic programming looks at it and kind of says, in whatever environment you're in, the inputs you take in, you react to. So you have a body reaction to it. You have an actual gut reaction to what's being thrown at you. Ordinarily, for us, that's good, because we choose the context we live in. So we chose to be in this room this evening, expecting something at least interesting and pleasant. Okay, what you hear, maybe something that's a little less predictable, but generally, we're choosing environments that are predictable. So what's happening with voices is number one, there's no choice. Number two, it's not predictable. So your emotional reaction, that gut reaction, certainly in the beginning, until you kind of learn to cope with it, is unpleasant. I mean, my voices, as I say, always have been downright freaking malign. I mean, they are really miserable. So of course what it does, it says provokes a fear response, and I've kind of described this in terms of Paul Gilbert's emotional systems. The Sue system kind of says, am I doing the right thing, basically, is what satisfies it. Your drive system, am I doing it right? And your threat system basically saying, is there no threat? Do no harm. These voices are throwing all this stuff at you, telling you you can't do this, you cannot do that, this is going to happen. When you see this person, this is what they're thinking. Every little thing that's going on, voices are interrupting and interfering with. So because this is such an unusual thing, what your mind is doing is trying to make sense of it. And because it is so in the way, at least for me, it was so very much in the way of everything I was trying to do, it was reflected very much in the context of what I was trying to do, not just with this information that was coming in, which was trying to make sense of it, but what I was trying to do in my life. So everything I was trying to do, voices were interfering. In fact, still do. So I learned using NLP techniques just to interrupt and replace with something else. So very simply, NLP, if you're kind of looking at it, so this is neurolinguistic programming the mind, or self-directed neuroplasticity if you want to look something up about it. If you think of just kind of four boxes in terms of what's happening in the flow of information and emotion, the input is arriving, normally you choose it, in this context you're not. You have a reaction to it, which is kind of how the information that comes in is connecting with your history, because that's your initial reaction. That your immediate reaction is based on all your shortcuts, your beliefs, your associations, all the shortcuts in your mind that actually help you process information sort of more quickly, what produced that initial emotional reaction. And a discomfort or a lack of equilibrium between the three emotional systems will prompt you to respond in a particular way. So this is the next thing, so input, reaction, response, and outcome are kind of the four boxes you think of in terms of neurolinguistic programming. So reaction is that sort of initial gut, but how you then process that information is based on your emotions and trying to reach emotional equilibrium. So you shape outcomes that actually satisfy your emotions. So in my case, this game of outcomes that voices want to impose on me versus outcomes in my life was set in the bigger picture of this war between good and evil, because voices kind of came along. Initially, when I realized we weren't the neighbors, they came along and described me as the perfect man for the job, leaving the job poorly defined, and then later asserted that I am the second coming. Which, of course, I decided I wasn't, but after about a year of voices insisting that I was, I said, well, damn, you won't be the second coming, and I will fix the world. So the outcome that I was looking for were always kind of in this context of improving the world. In this big scene, big world, small-town boy who's lived in five or six countries, landed up here, seen a lot of the world, I had some pretty smart ideas sort of about the world. So that's been the interaction, this kind of battle between good and evil, producing all these emotions that provoke my mind. Whether I like it or not, voices will say something and my mind goes. And what I've learned to do is to control that, but the game of the sort of outcomes has been very much on kind of fixing the world. So anyone else, Sheba included, just bear that in mind, what's kind of happening is that there is this constant prod all day of voices saying something that's striking something in the mind that literally one word can clear up a whole bunch of associations that produce that emotion, and what you're trying to do is find an outcome that settles that emotion to something comfortable. Good.
I would like to welcome to the stage Adrian Harris. Adrian is a faculty and supervisor at the New York University postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis and at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California. She publishes in the areas of gender and development. She co-edited The Legacy of Sandra Ferenczi Lewis Aaron. Her book, Gender as Soft Assembly, was published in 2005 by TAP. She is in private practice in New York City. Thank you.
Texts. Three men, each speaking against the power of diagnosis to disrupt subjectivity and citizenship. And I think also all three of them are very involved in the experience of writing as a way of claiming sanity and citizenship. And so that there is something about voices and personhood and subjectivity is at stake. The three people are Schreber. His dates are 1842 to 1911. The second is Louis Althusser, born in 1918 and dies in 1990. And the third is Vaclav Nijinsky, who's born in 1889 and dies in 1950. And I'm going to be mostly just reading their words. So first Schreber, from the memoir and then from the postscript. In the memoir he says, soul murder. The idea is widespread in the folklore and poetry of all people, that it is somehow possible to take possession of another person's soul. The voices which talk to me have stressed the fact that the crisis broke upon the realms of God was caused by someone having committed soul murder. During his second hospitalization, there was a long period of agitation and a determination to be freed from incarceration, in particular, tutelage, in which the incarceration is against one's will. And in that way, he thought, it undoes citizenship and individuality. This is Schreber again, one must make a distinction, therefore, between insane persons whose detention is in the public interest and those to whom this does not apply. To the first class belong all those insane persons who, through their illness, could become dangerous either to themselves or others, particularly cases of raving madness or melancholia, the latter particularly through the possibility of suicide. In general, one has to count amongst the same category persons who are admitted to the country house at Colditz, according to the regulation of 30th of July, 1893, namely incurable cases, where patients are deeply demented and abhorrent to look at. To the second class belongs all the other cases of mental illness, of a severe or lighter character, showing perhaps only a few delusions, of whom it cannot be said that being at liberty would be dangerous either to themselves or others. Mental illness of the latter kind I would like to designate as cases of harmless insanity for the purpose of their position in administrative law, irrespective of how these diseases are classified by scientific psychiatry. I'll read one more. It can therefore easily happen that the state of a mentally ill person who of his own free will entered a private asylum as a voluntary boarder undergoes such changes during his stay in the asylum that his immediate discharge would be dangerous for the patient himself. The Regulation 5, Part 2 of the Decree of 9th of August 1900 cannot be adduced in such a case, because it deals only with publicly dangerous mental patients. Can then a certain delay of the discharge for the purpose of informing the police or the relatives in order to transfer the patient to a public asylum be charged to the director of a private asylum as an unlawful deprivation of liberty in all circumstances? It appears to me that one must be extremely cautious before answering this question in the affirmative. Now I'm going to turn to Louis Althusser, and from his memoir titled The Future Lasts Forever. And there's an introduction by Douglas Johnson, who was a friend of Althusser's since the 1940s. And he writes in this introduction, Sunday, November 16th, 1980, at 8 or 9 that morning, he ran from his rooms into the courtyard of the École Normale Supérieure. Wearing a dressing gown over his pajamas, he was shouting dementedly, "My wife is dead, my wife is dead." The doctor is summoned. By then, Althusser is shouting, "I killed my wife, I strangled her." I've killed her. And just note the care with tenses, vocabulary, grammar. He is declared unfit to stand trial and remanded to care in an asylum, and he lived in some relation to the hospital at St. Anne and also to the university. In his memoir, as Johnson notes, he, Althusser, speaks as victim, and he writes, not unlike Schraber, to escape from, in quotes, the tombstone of the non-lieu, the grounds of refusal to order prosecution, the tombstone of the non-lieu of silence and public death. And so this is now from Althusser's memoir. I'm going to read a little from the first and second chapters. This is his voice. What follows, down to the last detail, is my precise memory of these events, forever engraved in my mind, through all my suffering. I shall describe what happened between two zones of darkness, the unknown one from which I was emerging and the one I was about to enter. Here is the scene of the murder, just as I experienced it. Suddenly, I was up and in my dressing gown at the foot of the bed in my flat at the École Normale. The gray light of a November morning, it was almost 9 o'clock of Sunday the 16th, filtered through the tall window to the left, onto the end of the bed. The window was framed by a pair of very old Empire red curtains, which had hung there a long time, tattered with age and burnt by the sun. Helene, also in a dressing gown, lay before me on her back. Her pelvis was resting on the edge of the bed, her legs dangled on the carpet. Kneeling beside her, leaning across her body, I was massaging her neck. I would often silently massage the nape of her neck and her back. I had learned the technique as a prisoner of war from Little Clerk, a professional footballer who was an expert in all sorts of things. But on this occasion, I was massaging the front of her neck. I pressed my thumbs into the hollow at the top of her breastbone, and then, still pressing, slowly moved them both, one to the left and the other to the right, up towards her ears where the flesh was hard. I continued massaging her in a V shape. The muscles in my forearms began to feel very tired. I was aware that they always did when I was massaging. Helene's face was calm and motionless. Her eyes were open and staring at the ceiling. Suddenly, I was terror-struck. Her eyes stared interminably, and I noticed the tip of her tongue was showing between her teeth and lips, strange and still. I had seen dead bodies before, of course. Never in my life looked into the face of someone who had been strangled. Yet I knew she had been strangled, but how? I stood up and screamed, "I've strangled Helene." This is a section from the second chapter in which he takes up the question of diagnosis, the non-lieu. I hope my readers will forgive me. I'm writing this book principally for my friends and for myself, if that is possible. My reasons will soon become clear. A long time after the drama occurred, I learned that two of my close friends had not wanted me to be declared unfit to plead, a decision based on the medico-legal opinions expressed by three experts at St. Anne's in the week following Helene's death. They would have preferred my case to come to court. Unfortunately, it was a pious wish on their part. I was in no fit state to take part in legal proceedings on account of my serious mental state. The examining magistrate who visited me could not get me to say a word. What is more, I no longer enjoyed my freedom or my civic rights, as I was automatically committed and under supervision on the orders of the prefect of police. Deprived of all choice, I was in fact the victim of an official procedure I could not escape, and to which I therefore had to submit. Certainly after such a long and trying experience, I'm surprised by my own understanding attitude towards my friends. When I speak of that trying experience, I refer not just to the period of confinement, but to my life since then, and what I clearly see I shall be condemned to for the rest of my days if I do not intervene personally and publicly to offer my own testimony. So many people with the best or worst of motives have risked speaking out or remaining silent on my behalf. Any individual who is declared unfit to plead is destined to be placed beneath a tombstone of silence. The grounds on which I was declared unfit to plead in February 1981 are summed up in the famous Article 64 of the 1838 version of the Penal Code, an article which is still in force despite 32 fruitless attempts to reform it. 4 years ago, into this delicate matter, which is inextricably bound up with a whole range of administrative, judicial, and penal powers linked to the science, ideology, and practice of psychiatry as it affects internment, the commission no longer meets. It appears it came up with nothing better. So I would just say that the man who invents interpolation ends up longing for it. The last piece I'm going to read is a letter that Nijinsky wrote to Diaghilev. Nijinsky's career was made by Diaghilev, and Diaghilev's ballet company was made by Nijinsky, who was an extraordinary dancer. When Diaghilev learns that Nijinsky is married, he fires him. Nijinsky has a breakdown and spends the rest of his life in the asylum. Robert Wilson and Grishnikov did this as a theater piece at BAM called Man to Man. To man, I cannot call you by name because you cannot be called by your name. I'm not writing to you quickly because I don't want you to think I'm nervous. I'm not a nervous man. I'm able to write calmly. I like writing. I do not like writing fine phrases. I never learned to write fine phrases. I want to write down thoughts, a new thought. I'm not afraid of you. I know you hate me. I love you as a human being. I do not want to work with you. I want to tell you one thing. I work a lot. I am not dead. I am alive. Within me lives God. I live in God. God lives in me. I am very busy working with dances. My dances are making progress. I write well, but do not know how to write fine phrases. It turns into a poem. You are mine. I am God. You have forgotten that God is. I have forgotten that God is. You are within me, and I am within you. You are mine, and I am yours. You are the one who wants death. You are the one who loves death. I love, love, love. I am love, but you are death. You are afraid of death, of death. One more.
We need to wrap up.
What? I am going to wrap up. I'm going to write one tiny little thing. Excuse me. I am a prick, but not yours. You are mine, but I'm not yours. Mine is a prick because the prick, I am the prick. I am the prick. I am God in my prick. I am God in my prick. Yours is a prick, not mine, not mine. I am a prick in his prick. I prick, prick, prick. You are a prick, but not the prick. I can prick, prick. You cannot prick a prick. I'm not a prick in your prick. I am a prick in his prick.
Loud and clear. Michael Egan is an American psychoanalyst and writer, perhaps best known for his willingness to allow the role of mysticism in the therapeutic process. Welcome to the stage.
I love Shrever. We look, let's all say together, chant together. We love Shrever. We love Shrever. We love Shrever.
Yeah.
Yo!
Yeah.
met him in my early 20s, 60 years ago, and he keeps giving. He hasn't stopped, keeps opening. He's given so much to so many people, and I certainly am here to celebrate and bear witness. I'm very excited that Evan and Marie have put this together. It's just astonishing and beautiful. I wrote about Schreber in my first book, The Psychotic Core, and there's a chapter there just alerting those who might not have known about it or read it. And he appears here and there throughout my work to the present day. My last book just came out a little bit. It's called Under the Totem, In Search of a Path. So that's where this, lots of things happen, is under the totem. Schreber, I think, is one of the signals of a revolution in culture. One of many signals. The Romantic movement is another. Freud is another. It's not an accident that Freud grooved on Schreber and made Schreber famous. It always amazed me, you know, Freud learned about Schreber from Jung. And it always amazed me that Jungians didn't do more with Schreber. I see Michael Renoy Adams is here today, and he has his Schreber paintings out front. So it's not that Schreber is without notice by the Jungians, but I think one of the things that happened is that Freud used Schreber many ways to free his own creativity, yes, to open up more of his own creativity, yes. The creative spirit has been mentioned here, the creative aliveness that both Henry and Adrian mentioned, the life of it, in or out of an asylum. It was Jung who said that, he was asked, what makes a great psychologist? And he says, someone who has to spend his life in a mental hospital, the only question being whether it's a doctor or a patient. So I don't know about that, the boundaries are blurred. And soul murder. I mentioned in the Psychotic Core that 80 years ago, if someone comes in and starts talking about soul murder, the psychiatrist might be a bit puzzled. But there are very few workers today, very few therapists today that would blink an eye. It would be an immediate affective resonance. Soul murder, of course. Of course, soul murder. It's a reality, an affective, a psychic reality. It's like everyone knows about it. Cult, you know, and who murders who? I murder you, you murder me. It's not it's out of the closet. We're all killers, and we've all been killed many, many, many times, often throughout a day from moment to moment. Now, in contrast to that, I was blown away about the same time that I read Schreber. I read Spengler, The Decline of the West, which is all about the cultural souls, the different souls of different cultures. Beautiful, beautiful book about all the cultural souls. And he commits, and nevertheless, he commits his own kind of soul murder. Let me see if I can go around it a little bit. The Bible says, the soul is in the blood, it says. The soul is in the blood. One of the reasons why there's so many rules about not eating the blood of animals, letting the blood out so you don't need a soul. If I were living in another culture, I'd say, let me eat the blood, I want the soul. I want the soul of the animal, like the caveman paintings. There's the soul of the animal in the paintings and the images. The soul is in the image. So Spengler says all these beautiful things about the culture, all the cultural souls. And then he says, about democracy. He says democracy is killing the soul with money. That money is killing the soul. And what will save the world, what will save the world is the blood, racial blood. This is, I'm just decline in the West, Penguin, not making it up. What will save the world is racial blood. And who did he mean is going to save the world? Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. The pure blood of the pure blood of the Aryan soul. Well, the racial blood will assert itself and vitality will come, and the curse and deadness of money will be vanquished by the vitality of the blood. Think D.H. Lawrence, think Wilhelm Reich, think Norman O'Brown, and think Schreber, the resurrection of the body, the resurrection of the body in this lifetime. Now, in ancient Greece, Aristotle felt that we link with God through our rationality. Act of reason to act of reason. I link with God through act of reason. A good friend of mine, I don't know how good, but in spirit good. We were close in spirit. We only met about 3 to 4 times. He wrote an immense book on the mystics and psychoanalysis. Wonderful, very interesting. I read all his works. He wrote on shamans, he wrote on all areas of spirituality. And when he gave me the chapter on me, he wanted me to look at it. I said, it's too heady, it's too heady. And he said, that's how he links with God. He links with God through his intellect. I thought about that, because that wasn't my primary way of linking to God. I was more like Schreber, nerve to nerve, nerve contact. It's more nerve, the soul and the nerve, the soul and the nerve, the soul and the image, the soul and the sense, the soul, nerve contact. That was like, you know, well, neurology was already in. Freud was a neurologist, you know, and neurology was getting bigger. The different kinds of neurology already. And if you look at the textbooks that Freud saw in the gymnasium, there's a lot of similarities to what's being taught now. Old brain, new brain, emotion, forebrain. Circumcision was going to happen here when I first walked in. Put this thing up here. Well, maybe it will be, because the prophet says the circumcision of the heart is what's needed. We have to circumcise our hearts. So,
we have 1 minute left.
1 minute! So the resurrection of the body, what are we going to do with it? What are we going to do with our nervy life? Oh my God. And I'm going to be a Jungian for a second. And talk about the four agencies, the four dimensions, intuition, intellect, sensation, and image, all of our capacities. I think we're at a point in evolution where none of our capacities can be shortchanged. What do we do with them? I don't think we know. I don't think we've evolved enough to know what to do with ourselves. But I think we've evolved with ourselves enough, some of us, to begin to notice that we don't know what to do with ourselves, and we are filled with amazing capacities. You touch any part of the body, and you can open worlds of beyond sensation. You can open amazing worlds any place you touch. You don't have to be a woman or a man or anything, any variation. Just any part of the human body opens worlds. More than the chakras, more than the Kabbalah Sephirot. Now Kabbalah has a lot of images in it. A big one is judgment. So Schreber fell into a conflict between judgment and sensory, spiritual, voluptuousness experience, the fullness of experience. Words like submit versus surrender, and again, the difference between control and fighting, which Weber was in, and opening. So right now, I think we're at an evolutionary point where we don't know what to do with ourselves, but we are amazed by all our capacities, not sure how to interrelate them. But that's our challenge, is in your life, in all our lives, to somehow become partners with our capacities and diminish somewhat the war model, the predator model, the fight model, all capacities against all capacities. All capacities nourish all capacities. How do we get there? That's an evolutionary challenge.
Marcus Bullen is a psychoanalyst in Berlin and Paris and a researcher affiliated with the University of Munich. He is also the 3-time award winner of the World Association of Psychoanalysis Best Haircut.
Thank you, Mother Potter. It has already been mentioned that the miraculously created birds do not understand the meaning of the words they speak. But apparently they have a natural sensitivity for similarity of sounds. Therefore, if while reeling off the automatic phrases they perceive either in the vibrations of my own nerves, my thoughts, or in speech of people around me, words which sound the same or similar to their own phrases, they apparently experience surprise. In a way, fall for the similarity in sound. In other words, they surprise makes them forget the rest of their mechanical phrases and they suddenly pass over into genuine feeling. It has already been said that the sounds need to be completely identical, that they don't need to be completely identical. A similarity suffices, as in the case of the birds do not understand the sense of the words, therefore it matters little to them. In order to give some examples, whether one speaks of Santiago or Cartago, Chinesentum oder Jesum Christum, Abendrot oder Atemnot, Ahriman or Ackermann, Briefbeschwerer or Herr Prüfer schwört, etc., etc. No one who has not personally experienced these phenomena like I have can have an idea of the extent to which speech has slowed down. To say, but naturally, is spoken or why do you not then shit? I spare them. And each requires perhaps 30 to 60 seconds to be completed. This would be bound to cause such nervous impatience in every human being, not like myself and more inventive in using methods of defense, as to make him jump out of his skin. A faint idea of the nervous unrest caused is perhaps the example of a judge or a teacher always listening to a mentally dull witness or a stuttering scholar who, despite all attempts, cannot clearly get out what is asked or wants to say. This section is generously put under the title of scholarly work, which I think is impossible to even correctly pronounce under the circumstances we are in, faced with Schreber, because I think there is no scholarly approach to what this book maybe not is about, but what this book has at least triggered very faintly in me that it is the document of someone who does nothing else but trying to speak. The whole book might be read by suspending the question of whether it's about homosexuality or not, whether it's about psychosis or not, or whether it's psychoanalytic or not, whether it's truth or delirium. Maybe just be the allegory of someone who is trying to say not something, but to just speak. And to speak in such a way that it does not offend the other. Document to this is the open letter written to Flexig at the beginning of the book, where he wants to say that Flexig has invaded him, but that it is not Flexig's fault, that Flexig did this by some force that was not in any way capable of being judged upon or of any moral quality. So what Shiva is saying to Flexig, you make me speak, and I'm grateful for it, but you also make me speak, so you did something to me, and I would have to reproach you for it, but I cannot do this because I received this gift from you, which is the gift of being able to speak. This is the scene he sets up, maybe in the letter this is an interpretation, or it's not an interpretation, it's what I would call a radical projection. And I think this is the other gift that is linked to the Schreber scene, is Freud's invention of a radical homophony between projection and projection. Like the little birds in Schreber, Freud uses projection on the one hand as a concept that is being able to understood and somehow makes sense, and on the other hand as something purely outside. Something that is just written into something that is not even there, no space where it would be able to be written into. Something like an absolute projection as another figure of the attempt of not saying anything, not producing speech, not conveying any message, but just being there speaking. Having received the gift of the possibility to speak by all the others around, and having to say this without offending them, and even without offending them by thanking them for the possibility to, offending them by thanking them for the possibility that has given to the person speaking. That's it. Thank you.
Mark Sanders teaches a seminar in comparative literature at NYU Paranoia, in which he spends several weeks on Schreber's book. He's also written an article on Schreber's paranoia as crisis of judging. His most recent book, Learning Zulu, a Secret History of Language in South Africa, published by the Princeton University Press, uses psychoanalysis to explore a psychopolitics of language and his own implications in it.
Thank you. I was going to deliver a scholarly commentary and then read from Schreber. I've decided to radically abbreviate the commentary and simply give the title. It's not the title on the program. The title is Primal Scene. If I were delivering the commentary, I would try to explain how the passage I'm going to read is a version of the primal scene. But I think I'd like to say something else in introduction to the passages that I'll read from Memoirs of My Nervous Illness, and is situated in the rhythm of Schreber's extraordinary book, that he spends a long time describing what in English is translated as compulsive thinking. In German, it's Denkzwang, so the compulsion to think. Greg was explaining earlier on, there's this continual dialogue for the voice here, and Schreber's experience is just like that. But in between describing and quoting the voices to which he is compelled to respond in thought or even in speech, there are anecdotes which give us an idea of Schreber's daily life. And I want to read from one of those passages. I have to preface it with a passage that Marcus already read, but I think this is one of the most fascinating passages in the book and gives an idea of the compulsion to think as few other passages do. The infringement of the freedom of human thinking, or more correctly, thinking nothing, which constitutes the essence of compulsive thinking, became more unbearable in the course of years with the slowing down of the talk of the voices. This is connected with the increased soul voluptuousness of my body, and despite all writing down, with the great shortage of speech material at the disposal of the rays with which to bridge the vast distances separating the stars where they are suspended from my body. No one who has not personally experienced these phenomena like I have can have any idea of the extent to which speech has slowed down. To say but naturally is spoken but naturally. Or why do you not then shit? Why do? And each requires perhaps 30 to 60 seconds to be completed. This would be bound to cause such nervous impatience in every human being, not like myself, more and more inventive in using methods of defense as to make him jump out of his skin. The faint idea of the nervous unrest caused is perhaps the example of a judge or teacher. Remember that Schreber was a judge. Always listening to a mentally dull witness or stuttering scholar who, despite all attempts, cannot clearly get out what he is asked or wants to say. So I skip a few paragraphs. I move on to what we might read as a day in the life of Schreber. An apparent description, anecdote, apparent break in the compulsive thinking, the compulsion to think. Because of its very characteristic meaning, I must devote a few more remarks to the above-mentioned question, why do they not shit? However indelicate the subject may be, like everything else in my body, the need to empty myself is also called forth by miracles. This is done by forcing the feces in the bowel forwards, sometimes also backwards. And when, owing to previous evacuation, there's insufficient material present, the small remnants in the bowel are smeared on my backside. This miracle, initiated by the upper God, is repeated every day at least several dozen times. Disconnected with the idea, which is quite incomprehensible for human beings and can only be explained by God's complete lack of knowledge of the living human being as an organism, that shh is to a certain extent the final act. That is to say, when the miracles produce the urge to shh, the goal of destroying my reason is reached, and so the possibility afforded for a final withdrawal of the rays. Trying to trace the origin of this idea, one must assume some misunderstanding of the symbolic meaning of the act of defecation, namely that he who entered into a special relationship to divine rays, as I have, is to a certain extent entitled to shh. on all work. At the same time, however, the whole perfidy of the policy conducted towards me is clear. Whenever the need to defecate is produced by miracle, some other person in my environment is sent to the lavatory by exciting the nerves of the person concerned in order to prevent me from emptying myself. This I have observed so frequently, thousands of times, and so regularly that one can exclude any thought of it being coincidence. The question, why do you then not shh, is followed by the capital answer, because I am somehow stupid. The pen almost resists writing down the fantastic nonsense that God, in his blindness and lack of knowledge of human nature, in fact goes so far that he assumes a human being could exist who something very every animal is capable of doing cannot shh for sheer stupidity. When I do empty myself, usually in the bucket, because I almost always find the lavatory occupied, this act is always combined with a very strong development of soul voluptuousness. Liberation from the pressure of feces present in the guts creates an intense feeling of well-being, particularly for the nerves of voluptuousness. The same happens when I pass water. For that reason, all rays have always and without exception been united during evacuation and passing water. And for this very reason, namely to avoid a union of all rays, one attempts, usually unsuccessfully, to miracle away the urge.
Kabir Dandana is a child psychotherapist working at the August Neckhorn Center for Adolescent Residential Care. He's also a candidate in the Child and Adolescent Program at HIPTAR. Welcome to the stage.
Let us suppose, as have others before us, that the world, the big one, out there beyond the family, however well the family might serve as a concentration and focus of currents and energies abroad, with all its chaos, commotion, abruption and volatility, its appetites, ideals and aspirations, its politics, mythologies, ordering principles, hierarchies and murder, let us suppose that this world impinges on the individual consciousness, penetrating it, in some sense fashioning it, however unaccountably. Let us suppose additionally that there are facts about this world so appalling that they cannot give out full, frank, daylight recognition by an individual consciousness, or indeed by a collective consciousness, and that this must be all the more so in instances in which the consciousness understands itself to be deeply invested in the world in question. So deeply invested in it as perhaps to be unable to tell itself apart from it, as to be effectively constituted by it. In such instances, let us allow that a mental mechanism of ancient provenance, refined over long periods of deep evolutionary time, asserts itself so as to deny the very facticity of appalling facts, transposing them instead into a realm in which they may be allowed recognition in only, or recognition only in somewhat distorted symbolic form. And let us call this mechanism repression. Let us for the moment not worry too much about this repression. Let us not ask when it is exactly, under which circumstances, in response to which stimuli the repressive mechanism asserts itself. Let us not ask for the moment just how the repressive mechanism is able, almost alchemically, to transform facts into metaphors. Let us not worry too much whether finally there exists a criterion with respect to which facts and metaphors may even be called apart. Let us not, in short, be too clever. We shall be naive, accepting the consequences, and shall leave rigour to the pedants and hacks of agony. Perhaps there is something to be gained by this approach. A chronology. As it happens, the dates are correct, but let's not be vulgar, looking for perfect coincidences or definite causalities. In 1884, Schreber spent some weeks at Sonnenstein Asylum. Also in 1884, delegates from the great powers of Europe met in Berlin to decide exactly how Africa was to be carved up, its lands distributed. In the same year, the Germans purchased land in what is today Namibia from the Nama tribe, declaring it a protectorate, in spite of the German government's knowledge that the land hadn't been quite legally acquired. The settlement of African territory by white Germans began. In accordance with the racial ideology then current in Germany, the overwhelming majority of white settlers considered themselves to be inherently superior to the Africans among whom they lived. And so rape of African women by white settlers was not uncommon. Nor, for that matter, was use of Africans as slaves in white plantations. In 1893, Schreber was admitted to Leipzig Psychiatric Clinic. In 1894, Schreber was transferred to Lindenhof Asylum, and from there to Sonnenstein Asylum, also in 1894. Theodor Luthwein was appointed governor of the German territories in Southwest Africa. The same year, the German government sent imperial colonial troops to pacify the region. In 1900, Schreber took legal action for his discharge. In 1901, Friedrich Retzel coined the term Lebensart, concentrating on the word ideas which had been in circulation for some time. Germany was experiencing at the end of the 19th century a demographic crisis. Too many people, not enough space to house them, not enough resources to provide for them. Extra land or living room is needed. Just as in Britain, France, and the United States, or rather just as Britain, France, and the United States had expanded to satisfy their needs, so too should Germany, by claiming territories in Africa, making satellite states of them, thereby creating the conditions for the perpetuation of modern German civilization. In 1903, Schreber's memoirs were published. In 1904, the German genocide of the Herero people commenced. General von Trotha drove the Herero people into the Kalahari Desert. A 200-mile-long installation of guard posts was erected to keep the Herero there. Tens of thousands of Herero thus died. In the same year, General von Trotha gave his annihilation order, committing to paper a plan to destroy the Herero people. Every Herero will be shot, he wrote. And later, in 1904, the first modern concentration camp was conceived, in which 4,000 Herero were held captive, beaten, starved, and worked to death by the army in the Second Reich. Herero prisoners were transferred like cattle in train cars between camp facilities. Their comings and goings were monitored with bureaucratic efficiency. Thousands of little tags were requested, produced in Germany, and sent to the colony for this purpose. Herero prisoners were rented as slaves to private German industries in the colony. Herero prisoners were used as slaves in the construction of a private railway line. 67% of those who worked on this line died from malnutrition and exhaustion. A death camp was established in Shark Island off the Namibian coast, conceived for the express purpose of the extermination of the Nama and Herero peoples. Shark Island became a leading center for the study of the emerging German racial sciences. The heads of 3,000 murdered Herero prisoners were sent to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin for anthropological analysis. In 1907, Schreber was admitted to the asylum at Leipzig Dösen. By 1907, as many as 100,000 Herero and 10,000 Nama had been killed in unprecedentedly modern fashion. The story of the German perpetrated genocide of the Herero people touches on every aspect of German modernity: science, bureaucracy, technology, politics, media, industry, commerce. This is perhaps no very big deal. It would have had to, given when the genocide occurred, and it did. What is more disturbing is the idea propagated by Friedrich Ratzel and shared in by large segments of the German population, that German modernity was a project which was viable only insofar as it was capable of arrogating to itself the resources needed for its perpetuation, even if this should require murder. What is German modernity then? What is modernity more generally? however sensitive, the honest, to square the murder that is its very condition with the taller claims which may be made on its behalf? What of Schraber, the Senate's president, high official of the Second Reich? He drew breaths from a heady modern atmosphere. What became of the air once in his lungs, his brain? How did it react? How might Schraber have resolved the discord between the noblest proclaimed modern purpose and the basest of modern deeds? What did he mean by soul murder?
Intrapsychic events, they are reactions to the environment, for Christ's sake. And that is forgotten. Even McAlpin and Hunter, McAlpin is also a psychoanalyst, and she says, there is only the intrapsychic that counts. But if Freud meant to say that, he was very wrong. Actually, what Freud says from the very beginning is there is an interaction. And this comes, I wrote a special paper about it under the title Emotional Reality, which remains for a psychic reality, as it was much deeper. So, what you are reading, Marcus, as his words, were related to his fear of being declared by a crippling psychiatry, i.e., by his representative in the asylum, that he was suffering from a verblödung, the final state of paranoia. Or what was then came to be known as dementia precox, or dementia paranoidus. So Schraber is here dramatizing the impression that people might have of him as being an idiot, that he's already in the stage of dementia and he doesn't know what he's talking about. You cannot interpret this text without relating it to what was actually going on in his life at that time. And this was my lesson. Otherwise, you're talking in the air. Now, the same was done tonight about the idea of soul murder. It was not a psychotic idea. The interesting thing is when I looked at the German dictionary, Seelenmord, they gave a definition in Italian. Omicidio spirituale dell'anima. So what does it mean? It's that you're doing some cruel thing to a person, and as a result of it, he feels that he's torn in a psychological sense, that his soul is under assault. Now, Niederlein talked about, wrote a lot about concentrations of concentration victims, applied soul murder to the murder of the soul of the invalid. And this was exactly Schraber's position. It was an invalid, a Dämon. It's not so much Dämon, it's that Zwang of being hospitalized against his will. And there he is day in, day out. And what is the poor guy to do? I mean, he goes through all kinds of moves and fears. Now, this concept of soul murder itself was a juridical concept in the first half of the 19th century. defined by a very famous jurist called Anselm Feuerbach. He was the father of Ludwig Feuerbach, who then became a very famous philosopher. And Anselm Feuerbach applied the chainsaw murder to a very famous case in those days, the case of Kaspar Hauser. Kaspar Hauser was a child who was a prisoner in a cellar for many years, and one day he was given freedom. But because he was like a wild child on their own, he never learned to speak. Then he did. So what Anton Feuerbach does in his book with Zedelmoy, he says this is a malpractice of a doctor who destroys the soul of his patient through acts of malpractice by mishandling, by misfeeding the patient. And Schreber, who of course knew that word, applies this word in the letter, the open letter of the retrospective. And that's an important thing. It was added to the book just before it was printed in March of 1903. The book was already written in 1900 and 1901, etc. And there, then he says, Dr. Flexing, you committed soul murder on me. By this he meant, he put this. There's the two psychiatrists that dealt with him. One kicked him out, and the other one held him a prisoner.